said to me, we'd love to employ you, but there's one condition. You need to take your earring out. I learned how not to treat presenters when they're on the air. Be very careful about experimenting, because if it goes wrong, you're the one that will lose out.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Steve Collins.
Yeah, I grew up in a small village just outside of Cambridge. My brother and I, we liked entertaining for some reason. I don't know if the family came around, my grandparents or whatever. We'd often put on a little show to entertain them. One of my school reports, our PE master wrote, has trouble kicking a ball. I think that's because I hated kicking balls. I didn't want to play football. I hated it. My schooling was great. You know, it was good fun. It was nice, but nothing that stands out particularly. You know, I had a really nice upbringing. It was good and always supported me. I didn't take the 11 plus. I had the choice whether I could take it or not. And my mum and dad said, look, it's up to you. We'd rather you do. But if you don't want to, then don't. Because I thought, I don't want to go to a grammar school where most of my friends won't go. Because I knew only a few people get through the 11 plus, and most of the people I knew in my secondary school would go to the local village college. I did a milk round when I was, about 12, 13, on Saturdays and Sundays, and very, very long hours for next to nothing. And I saved up my money each week until I bought a Kubaya radio. It was what you call a tranny radio, transistor radio, with a big knob on the front. I remember it was red, which was quite modern at the time. A big, not bright red, but a red colour with a big round knob on it to tune in the radio stations.
Man, a fabulous record. The Jackson 5 there, and that's a number called I Want You Back. Number 2 this week in the Fan 30. This is Wonderful Radio 1. The time is exactly 8:30, and over to Ray Moore in the Radio 1 newsroom.
Leaders of the main teachers' union.
My mum always had Radio 1 on. I remember as a very, very young kid, we had this really old, really old-fashioned Bakelite type radio, which used to crackle a lot. And in the evening sometimes, Radio Luxembourg would go on as well. So I used to listen to that as well. I think I got into music when I was about 14 or 15, really. For me, the year of music started in probably 1969. I remember, I don't know if it was actually 1969, but I remember Love Like a Man by 10 Years After, which was, I love that song. I wasn't particularly into rock music, but it was a sort of a rocky period, so I was quite influenced by it. But later on, I became more influenced by soul music, I think.
Big L time is 3 o'clock, and Radio London is now closing down.
I do remember vaguely the day that Radio London closed down. I remember a lot of people saying at the time, because I was a bit too young, that today's the day it goes. But it didn't really mean that very much to me. What meant a lot more to me was the times that Radio North Sea closed down, which they did a couple of times.
We've been through a lot together and come out smiling, and I'm sure we'll all come out smiling from this. All of the announcers on RNI have a great future ahead of them, and I wish them well. Thank you to Mr. Bollier and Mr. Meister and to everyone around me for all the encouragement, and thank you for your support. Goodbye.
RNI sells happiness.
I bought a second-hand, big old-fashioned radios. I went to a second-hand shop and bought that. It had shortwave on it, and I could tune around and listen to lots of different radio. I became an avid radio listener, and it wasn't necessarily the music. Well, it was the music, but not necessarily the music. It became radio rather than the music that I got into, I think. I mean, I love music, obviously, but music is, I think you get a bit ruined in some ways by playing songs, because they become a tool of your trade rather than something that you necessarily enjoy.
And that's the start of the Pick of the Pops Top 10 this week. Came in at 27 3 weeks ago. Last week, number 20. This week, right up to number 10 in the Pick of the Pops Top 10. The drift is there, and come on over to my place. And here we go again. Bang into the top 10 at number 9 comes...
I remember that I wanted my hair cut like Alan Freeman because he had it. Because at the time I used to have short back and sides because I was a kid, as all kids did back then, and Fluff's hair was long. I said to my mum, I want to grow my hair, I want it like Fluff's. And she said, okay. And I remember going to the barber's and asking him if he would cut my hair like Alan Freeman's was. And he said to me, does your mum know that you're having this done? And I said, oh, yeah, it's all right, yeah.
And he's gone and done it again, all right. Came in last week at number 22 in the Pick of the Pops Top 30.
Because I used to, like many people, record the Top 40 on a Sunday with the pause button on the cassette machine. And Radio Luxembourg was quite important to me. I remember the Royal Ruler, Tony Prince and Stuart Henry. You know, I used to love listening to them. They were a little bit like pirates in a way, whereas Radio 1 was far more establishment. I love R&I because I felt that there were these guys sat out in the middle of, 3 miles off the coast of either Holland or Britain, whichever station it was. They sat out there and they were playing music for me, and they weren't part of the establishment. They were rebels, really. And, you know, I think as a kid I was a bit of a rebel, not a bad one, but and so I liked that. Again, I think that's one reason that I wanted to do radio myself, because it was about, not rebelling, but about, I've got these songs I really want to play for you. So that was one of the reasons I really liked R&I. And also they played a much, much wider variety of music than Radio 1 did, because they were obviously influenced by Holland as well, because there were a lot of Dutch bands that they played that never ever got aired on Radio 1. So it gave me access to a much greater variety of music. I mean, a lot of it was, or some of it was crap, but some of it was good as well. One particular record that stands out, which was released in this country eventually, was the George Baker Selection and Una Paloma Blanca. I mean, terrible record, really. Una Paloma Blanca. At the time, you know, when R&I played it, Radio 1 wasn't playing it. That kind of switched me on to it. Also, when Radio Atlantis came on as well, it sounded like a lot of people just having a lot of fun on that radio station. I absolutely loved Radio Atlantis for the very short time that it was on the air.
Radio Atlantis.
I didn't know what I wanted to do when I left school. I remember going to the local careers guy who came to the school every now and again. He said to me, so what do you want to do when you leave school? I said, I'm not really sure. And he said, well, you better think about that, hadn't you? And that was my meeting with the careers officer. But I wanted to work in radio by this time. But by the time I was, you know, 15, 16, I thought that's what I want to do. But I got a job working for Cambridgeshire County Council, which I absolutely hated. Oh, God, thinking back to it, it was a cushy number. I just didn't enjoy. It didn't give me any buzz. It didn't give me any enjoyment. It didn't give me anything to want to do it. And I remember I've been there a couple of years. I applied for a promotion into another department, and I was interviewed by the guy there, and he said to me, so what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to earn as much as possible for doing as little as possible. And I still got the job.
220 Radio Nazi.
You know, I was just obsessed with R&I, because when I left school, I didn't go straight to work. I went to sixth form college. And, you know, I remember writing all over my books, R&I this, the sound of Europe, the voice of Europe, the sound of the world. You know, I was obsessed with it. So after 6 years of working in local government, I was running a mobile disco as well, which was great fun, because we used to try and run it a bit like a radio station in some ways. After about 6 years, I saw an advert, I think it was in Record Mirror, for DJs wanted for a Middle East radio station. And I was sending letters off left, right and centre to every single radio station. I've still got them in the loft from some people that are still in the industry now that have rejected me. But I applied to this advert, sent in a demo tape, and they called me up and said, we'd like you to go in a week's time. So I went into work, into the council offices, and I said, look, I know I'm supposed to give a month's notice, but I've had this opportunity to go to the Middle East to work on a radio station, and they let me go within a week, probably glad to get rid of me, actually.
from somewhere in the Mediterranean. Peace, love, and good music. The voice of peace is your voice, 24 hours a day.
When I arrived in Tel Aviv, I was put into a hotel in the red light district. Believe me, it was horrendous. It was absolutely horrendous. There were all these women going, hey, come on, come on. And it was terrible. And, you know, I was a 22, 23-year-old, never been away from home. And it was pretty scary, actually. Maybe I was lived a sheltered life. I don't know. But I remember going into the hotel bedroom, and there was this mud footprint on the sheet. So I stayed in the room. I only stayed there one night. And luckily, the ship was in a harbour when I arrived for some repairs. So I didn't actually go out on the tender first time. And so I got onto the ship whilst it was in harbour. It was about, I don't know, 200 feet long. It was in quite good condition. It looked as though it was in quite good condition. It had been painted. But when you got on board, you realised that it probably wasn't in such great condition. The cabins were mainly two people per cabin. And always the new person got the cabin with the bed where the air conditioning leaked onto it. So that was my first place I stayed. We had a chef who was, I think he was an alcoholic. Although we were only allowed two beers a day, we were given them free. In fact, I think we were only allowed one beer a day, but people used to save them up and then drink them all at once. I think most of the crew were probably on the run from the police. The captain was, God, he was a weird man. I remember once when we were having the sea was quite rough on one particular occasion, which you wouldn't think it would be out there, but it was. And I remember the chef, the alcoholic chef, had strapped himself to the cooker while he was cooking this big stew in this huge great cauldron, and he was stirring it. But as he was stirring it, the sweat on his brow was dripping into the stew. It was bloody disgusting. But as a young lad, it didn't really matter that much to me. It was, although I wasn't used to it, but you soon adapt. It's amazing how you adapt to things. I remember I was homesick for a while. That's because I hadn't been away from home before for any length of time. And I remember at night time in the Middle East, the skies are really clear and you can see every single star in the sky. So every night we used to go up to the end of the ship and we used to look up. We used to just sit there and chat and look at the stars. That stays with me, that it was just an important time where you just talk about home and friends and loved ones and things. You just get to know each other very, very well in that kind of situation. So I was happy there, but I knew that it was something I didn't want to do for too long.
Ici la voix de la paix, émettant de quelque part dans la Méditerranée sur 1540 kilocycle.
From somewhere in the Mediterranean, we are the voice of peace on 1540.
I went in 1977. It was pretty tough out there. Tel Aviv then was not like it is today. It hadn't developed as much. A.B. Nathan started the voice of peace, and I do think he genuinely wanted to influence peace in the region, because at the time it was not good. You know, I remember I'd never seen it before, but there were, you know, in the cinemas, there were soldiers with guns outside the cinemas. The Navy would practice and you couldn't see their boats, but when they fired their guns, our ship would jump out of the water. And I found that pretty scary. So it was about peace. And when AB came on board, which he did now and again, thankfully not that often because he was a pain sometimes, there was this program in the evening called the Peace Program. It was an hour's worth of peace music. And, you know, he would go on the air himself.
Go placidly amid the noise and haste and remember what peace there may be in silence. As far as possible, without surrender, be on good terms with all persons. Speak your throat quietly and clearly.
I was quite amazed, really, because he would just sit there and talk about peace. And I thought, you know, this guy is actually genuine. A lot of people say he was nuts, and he probably was to a degree. But I do think he had a genuine belief that he could influence peace. You know, he took a few, he did a few things that were dodgy. He took the ship through the Suez Canal, I think, but that was before I joined it, to try and get some peace going. But, you know, I had a lot of respect for him because of what he was doing. Why he started a pop radio station to try and get some peace going, I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. Maybe he felt that that was a way to get to the people, to get his message across. I mean, it was great fun, and I'm so glad I did it. It's probably one of the best things I've ever done because, you know, I can say that I've worked in pirate radio, albeit in the Middle East rather than off the coast of the UK. But it was very, very special to me, and I learned a lot there. When I first arrived and was on air, I was terrible. But I worked with Howard Rose, who at the time was still Crispy and St. John. You know, he drummed into us 7-second links and, you know, forward progression and all that kind of stuff, keep it moving. And that was the kind of radio I loved. Also, there was the camaraderie of being on the ship together, with you're all in this together type of feeling, which is what I felt I was listening to when I listened to R&I. I went initially for 3 months, and I did consider staying longer, but decided not to do so because I wanted to come back and get into radio back in the UK. You know, I thought, oh, I've got some experience now, I'll get a job. But it wasn't that easy, obviously. I got back and immediately went on to the Dole. Luckily, I got some money saved because I earned absolutely nothing on The Voice of Peace. We weren't paid wages, we were paid expenses, so I didn't make any money there. But luckily, before I went, I got a little bit of money saved, so I lived on that. I didn't want to go back into a regular job. I wanted to work in radio. And so I spent probably a year nearly just doing nothing, really, and applying for jobs. And that's when I saw an advert for Topshop for a DJ in a store, which I thought, oh, that's a novel idea. So I applied for the job and was called in for an interview in Oxford Circus. And Adrian John was the DJ. And the reason that the job had come up is because Adrian was opening Top Shops around the country. They would hire a celebrity, go and open the shop and have loads of people there. So Adrian went onto the road, and so his job became vacant in store. So I went for the interview, and they said, yeah, we think you can do the job. Will you start? I said, yeah, when? They said, tomorrow, which was fantastic, really. The studio, because it was a studio, pretty basic equipment, was in the Oxford Circus Top Shop at the time. There were huge escalators that go down into the store, and underneath those escalators was a little room, which was the studio. It was a tiny little room, actually. The job really was to promote, because it was a massive store, it was to promote the different departments, because there were a lot of concessions in there, you know, Bieber and other, I can't think of any others, but it wasn't just Topshop clothing. It was also concessions as well. So it was to promote their goods to people coming in, because at the time, Topshop in Oxford Circus used to get absolutely rammed. It was unbelievable. I was just gobsmacked at how many people would be in there, particularly on a Saturday.
Bundy shorts in satin that she doesn't look too fat in. Topshop.
So it was basically a promotional job, but I thought, well, this is quite good. It could be a radio station, because it wasn't really a radio station. It was, the equipment was glorified disco equipment, good stuff. I mean, it was an Alice mixer, I think, and a couple of pretty good Gerard turntables. But I thought, you know, we can run this as a radio station rather than just being a promotional thing for the shop. That's really how it all came about. It was me pushing for it to become a radio station, to have their own in-store radio station. It was just a Top Shop at the time, because above was Peter Robinson, that later became Top Man, and so it was piped up there as well. So all the girls from the different departments would bring round their things they wanted me to promote, and I would do it. But and it was amazing that I contacted record companies, and they would bring in the promotional copies, because it was at a time when the New Romantic thing was going on. it was pretty cool there. So I kind of got into that, really. You know, I remember a promo guy bringing in Duran Duran's Planet Earth as a, I was going to say white label, but it was a red label. And he said to me, he said, have a listen to this if you want to play it. He said, I've just taken it down to Radio 1, which was just down the road from Oxford Circus. I've dropped it off there. I don't know whether they'll play it, but will you play it? So I probably played Planet Earth before Radio 1 did. I remember the guy from Lynx, not David Grant, the other one, when I came back from lunch once, was sat outside the studio on the floor with his new song, Intuition, to see if I would play it for him. So it became a place where people would try and get their songs played. And that was just by treating it as a radio station. It's really, really weird. I often wonder how the hell I managed to convince the powers that be there to buy proper professional studio equipment, which they did. You know, we had a Gates turntables, you know, proper studio broadcast turntables and jingle machines and everything. And it was a radio station. It was a bit like, I suppose, the UBN had been a few years before. Eventually, I got the little room knocked into the room behind and made into two studios. So we had a bigger studio, and then later on, Top Shot in the West One Shopping Centre, which was just further down Oxford Street near Selfridges, opposite Selfridges. I convinced them to put in a landline. I mean, there were no ISDNs then, but I convinced them to put in a landline so we could broadcast from Oxford Circus to the West One Shopping Centre via landline. A lot of people that went into broadcasting went through the doors of Chop Shop. I remember Paul McKenna, when he was about 15 or 16, wandering in one Saturday because, you know, he used to go and to see Kenny Everett at Capitol. And he came down one Saturday after seeing Kenny Everett and popped in and wanted to see the studio. And he came in a few times, and there was one occasion where I had to go and do something. I can't remember. I said, oh, you take over, you do it. And so I gave him a go. And eventually he got a job there as well. Top Man! I was applying for jobs in proper radio whilst I was at Top Shop. I sent a demo up to Keith Macklin at Red Rose Radio because they were advertising. They were coming on the air back in 1982. He came into Top Shop to see me. Yeah, it was really weird. Dear old Keith coming into Top Shop. But there he was. He came in and we had a chat. And then I was invited up to Preston to meet him again. At the time, I was wearing an earring because they were fashionable back then. And he said to me, we'd love to employ you, but there's one condition. I said, oh, right, okay, what? And he said, you need to take your earring out. Oh, right, okay, I will. So I did. After the first day, I put it back in again. Dave Lincoln said, don't be so stupid, put it back in. Yeah, so Red Rose came about. That was my first real job in radio.
My name is Owen Oyston, the chairman of Red Rose Radio, Lancashire's first independent local radio station. I'm delighted to welcome you on behalf of our presidents, managing director, directors and staff to our first day of broadcasting to the Lancashire community.
Again, the camaraderie. It was the old days of ILR where, you know, it was very, very regulated. But because it was way outside of London, you could get away with a lot. Every minute of the day, we used to laugh. And because I was there by myself, I got no home life. So I used to hang around the radio station all day, as did others as well. So you get to know people pretty well. And it was a bit like pirate radio in many respects. You're all in it together and you're doing it. Because Red Rose was massive when it first came on the air. Wherever you went, you know, it was just unbelievable, really. But I hated being in Preston. I'd been working in London for 4 or 5 years, and all of a sudden I was up in Preston. And it's not Preston of today, it was Preston of 1982, and it was a lot different back then. I lived in this grotty little flat, which actually the station sorted out for me. It was in a rough part of town, and you know, I used to go back down south most weekends. I used to do the late show, and quite rightly so, I think, because I'd got not very much experience in radio. But what happened was we had one day of dry runs, and the guy who was taken on to do breakfast was a lovely man, but he just wasn't up to it, really. So Dave Lincoln, who was down to do mid-mornings, they decided to put Dave on to breakfast. So I ended up doing the mid-morning show. So my very first job in radio was doing mid-morning with, you know, the morning market and all that kind of stuff, and the weekly local woman that did the recipe and all those kind of ILR things that you used to do. And I got no experience of doing this. And, you know, looking back, I was probably terrible. But eventually, because Dave was doing all the music, Dave Lincoln doing all the music and running the station, basically, he was finding it very difficult doing breakfast as well. So we swapped over. So I was put onto the breakfast show, which was probably not a great move for me, really, if I'm honest. But it was a good experience, I suppose. Red Rose was a church, and I can always remember the smell of it because it was a cross between a church smell and new carpets. But it had a distinct smell about it. Not horrible, but it's something that sticks in my mind. And it was a good building. It was very nice. There was Alan Bezick. He was a real character.
Robin. All right, Alan, how you doing, mate? What I want to talk about is student union facilities in Preston. We're talking about £20 a week, and the cleaners have gone on strike and everything. What do you think we should do about it?
I think you should grab a brush. Clean them up, you lazy
Yeah,
son.
I know that.
Clean them up, for crying out loud. You've got balls all else to do all day. Clean them up.
And Dave Lincoln, I got on well. I mean, Dave and I have worked a lot together over the years. So they're the main two, really. And, you know, Julian Allett was the newsman. He was a character. I don't really know much about the business side of things there. I didn't even know what the Radar, although they were Jikra back then, weren't they? What the figures were, we were never told. Lovely, lovely Keith Macklin. He was such a dear, dear person. Not really cut out to be a program controller, really, because he was too nice. David Maker ran the show, really. And I've got a lot of respect for David Maker. He was a real bastard, but I've got a lot of respect for him. You know, I remember once when I was doing the breakfast show one morning, and I made a joke, I can't remember what it was, some joke on the air. About half an hour later, he came in to work, and he came straight in the studio, and he said to me, "Steve, don't try and be funny, because you're not." And he walked out again, and I was obviously devastated, but he was absolutely right. He was absolutely right. You know, it was a big lesson that I learned. I learned how not to treat presenters when they're on the air, and also you have to learn hard lessons sometimes, and that was a pretty hard lesson. But, you know, it was things like that that I'm really grateful for, because I learned so much while I was there. You know, I learned, you know, with playlists where you take from with the 45s, you take from the front and put to the back of the A, B and C list and things like that. And I learned how to interview people. I remember once I got into trouble because, you know, I didn't consider myself as an ILR type of jock. I wanted to be this hip jock, and I remember I went to an event somewhere, and I looking back, a stupid thing I said. I said, "I'm the guy that does the mid-morning show, you know, the mid-morning market, you know, that dreadful mid-morning market," because I did think it was dreadful, but it was very, very popular. I got into such trouble for that. But I said it as a joke, but it was taken in the wrong way. One of the advertisers had a shop opening. It was a fashion store in the centre of Preston, and they had Musical Youth. They were really in vogue at the time. And they had to close the streets of Preston off because Red Rose was there and Musical Youth were there. And there were thousands and thousands of people. It was unbelievable, really, thinking about it. That would never happen now. Never happen. Red Rose Radio. But I desperately wanted to get back to London. And before I'd gone to Red Rose, I'd applied to Capital. I sent a tape to Capital, and I met Peter James, who was running the station at the time. I think he was head of programs at Capital. And he said to me, "We quite like what you do, but you need some experience. So go and get some experience on a radio station, then come back to us." And I'd been at Red Rose for about 9 months, and I got the phone call from Peter James. "I'm in the area. Do you want to meet?" So I met him, and he offered me a job, 6-month holiday relief contract. I thought, "Oh, wow." So I went in the next day and asked if I could leave, and I was told, "No, you've got a contract, you can't go." But eventually they saw sense and they let me go. So I went to Capital in 1983 and stayed there for 6 years. 95.8 FM. You know what? My first day of Capital, I can remember being nervous and going in. I remember Roger Scott was there and Alan Freeman. I don't know who else, but Fluff came over to me and he said, "You're Steve Collins, aren't you?" And I thought, how the hell does he know that? And I said, yes, I am. And he shook me by the hand. He said, welcome to the Capital family. And, you know, I will never forget that. It made me feel at ease straight away. Such a lovely man, he really was.
Good evening, London. The capital weather tonight. Tonight and tomorrow morning will be cloudy with occasional showers.
I was overwhelmed by it, really, because it was a dream come true. I didn't necessarily make it big at Capital, but I did okay. You know, I stayed there for 6 years, and it was my choice to leave when I finally did. Peter James was there, but Joe Sandilands was the... Oh, I don't know. He was head of programme. She was programme director or something. So Peter James offered me the job, and then I went in to meet Joe Sandilands, and she didn't seem to be very hands-on with running it day-to-day with the jocks. It was more Tony Hale. She was a journalist, so she come from magazines, hadn't she? So I didn't find her very radio-orientated, but I didn't have that much to do with her. So maybe I'm being a little unfair. I mean, I met her when I first went there, and she was nice to me, very nice. The management were upstairs, and the jocks and Tony Hale were downstairs with the producers in the playpen. But I was taken on to fill in as holiday relief. So I did lots of different shows. I always remember Michael Aspel used to call me Stephen. Hello, Stephen.
This is Capital Radio, Wednesday, the 18th of July. Time for the news from IRN.
I remember I did the breakfast show for Graham Dean once. I wasn't good. I was not good at that. I found it quite difficult in that the programmes were produced properly. The producer would sit in the studio with you. When you put your headphones on, they would put their headphones on. And, you know, they would say to you, right, you need to be out of this record by 57:22. You know, these days, you just do it yourself. Whereas then, you relied on them to do it for you. I found that a bit daunting, really. I felt as though I wasn't in control of me being the person on the air. So I did struggle with that for a while. Most of the shows I did were a lot of early shows and overnight. So, and you just did those by yourself, so that was easier. And then I eventually got my own two shows. One was a Saturday morning early show, and then a Saturday night overnight soul show. And I used to go to... I can't remember the name of the record shop. I used to be given an allowance by Capital to go and spend about 40 quid a week or something on records. So I used to buy imports. And some of the songs that I used to get, you know, I remember Galveston Bay by Lonnie Hill. Before it was released in this country, I was playing that on Capital. You know, and I did build up a bit of kudos as being a soul DJ for a little while. And I remember Record Mirror voted me one of the soul DJs of the year. Once. I think Tony Hale, head of music, was taken ill, and so they brought in Richard Park as head of music. And then he eventually, when Joe Sandilands left, and I mean, I don't know what went on there, but when she left, he became the program director. And he changed Capital. He brought it out of the old-fashioned ILR thing into the new modern jockey type of thing, because Laser had been on the air, and Laser had really hurt Capital, I think.
UB40, many rivers to cross. I tell you, any mention of water is a bit too much out here. You're with Laser 558 and Jesse Brandon, rocking and rolling on the North Sea on a sunny Thursday afternoon.
So it needed to modernize, which it did. I mean, he got all the American jingles made and popped it up a lot and made it more showbiz, which it needed to be, and especially being in London. He left me alone, really, because I was doing the early show, and so, although important because it's warm-up for breakfast, was probably not his main focus. I think most people were frightened of him. I mean, not in a terrifying way, but he was quite scary. You know, he ran a tight ship, and he took no shit. And if he thought you were giving shit, you knew about it. So, a bit like a football manager. I think that's how he saw it. I was just amazed at what he did with the radio station. Amazed.
Let's have a look at the weather. Thank you, Kenny.
My claim to fame on Capital is that I was the last presenter to broadcast on AM and FM, in that on the day of the split to Capital FM and Capital Gold, and so I was on AM and FM before it, and my last link was live to FM and pre-recorded on AM. So there's a claim to fame for me. I then got to do the early show, Monday to Friday, And then when Richard Park came in, he kept me on that. I would go on the air Monday to Friday. I'd get out of bed at about 2:45, drive in, because I lived in Hemel Hempstead, go on the air at 4, come off the air at 6:30, drive home, have about half an hour's kip, get back on the train and go back into London until about 4 o'clock, and run Top Shop as well. So doing that for a couple of years was enough. And so eventually I was offered a job at County Sound. Mike Powell offered me a job, and I remember going to Richard Park and saying that I've been offered this job. And he said to me, well, he said, I'm not going to tell you to stay, I'm not going to tell you to leave, it's up to you. He said, I'm not going to move you off the early show, you're doing all right on it, why should I? He said, I might do one day, but at the moment I'm not. Mike Powell rang me up. He said, you know, we're interested in you doing a breakfast show on County Sound. And I said, oh, I'd never listened to the station. I said, well, I'll give it a listen and see. And I listened. And it was just not me at all. I said, why do you want me? I don't understand, because the station sounds nothing like I sound. And he said, because we want to change the sound of the radio station and we think you'd fit it. And that was one of the things I said to Richard Park when I asked him what he thought. And he said to me, be very careful about people that are experimenting, because if it goes wrong, you're the one that will lose out. And he turned out to be absolutely right about it. But anyway, I decided to take the job, and because I just felt like I needed a change. So I was going to do the breakfast show, and Mike wanted a double header with Diana Luke.
County Sound provides two great radio stations for Surrey and Hampshire. Premier FM on 96.4 plays the latest hits, the greatest memories, and you can hear the UK's original
Gold. And we got on great off air, on the air. We didn't get on that well because our styles are very, very different. So just putting two people together on the air, you need to have a lot more than just that, and it just didn't work. But, you know, again, I got a lot of experience at County Sound doing different things. I went with Mike Powell to Dallas to jam, to have the jingles made. So, you know, at least I got to go there and meet John Walford and wonderful Jingle Company. 96.4 FM, Stereo Premier Radio. But just as a double header, Diana's great, a good broadcaster, but my style was very much, right, we need to do this by that time, and then that, we'll do that, and then, you know, we finish at 25-ish and move, you know, all that sort of stuff. Whereas she was saying, oh, let's just see how we go. And we clashed because of it. And so it didn't work out at all for me. It was my fault, a bad move on my part, going there and expecting to be able to change the radio station, which had a however many years behind it as being one thing and then becoming something else. You know, I couldn't create that. And so I didn't get my contract renewed. You know, I think quite rightly. At the time, I was pretty pissed off. I felt that I'd been hard done by. I'd decided to take up an offer. I felt stabbed in the back in that they didn't renew my contract. But looking back, I think Mike was absolutely right. And it came at a time when the station was being sold as well. So it was a bit of a difficult time for me, that, really. But, you know, it's the nature of the business. You've got to get used to losing your job now and again. You know, it's happened 3 or 4 times to me. But it was difficult. It was very difficult. Luckily for me, Jazz FM was changing and had just been bought by Golden Rose, basically David Maker, who I knew. And Rob Jones had been brought in as consultant to set up the station. So I got in touch with Rob. So they offered me a job. And I ended up being at Jazz FM for 2 years. I mean, it was a very, very weird, weird radio station to work for. But it was great fun. It was because at the time, things were pretty tough. We were unsure some months whether we'd get paid or not, because the station wasn't making any money. It was a bit of camaraderie. I ended up doing all daytime shows over the 2 years that I was there. We used to get swapped around regularly. I mean, the music was a bit weird. You know, you could go from playing a Spandau Ballet because it had got a saxophone in it to playing a bit of, you know, a bit of heavy blues. You know, I'm not a particular jazz fan at all, but it was great fun. And I was back in London as well, working on a London radio station. with not very many listeners, obviously, but although it's probably got as many as it has now, as Smooth. But we never knew from day to day what was going to happen to the radio station. It was a weird feeling. In the building, the jocks were downstairs, and it was a huge area, but there was nobody there. Just weird. Weird.
I bet your pop staples will be singing that one on the 4th of July at the Crystal Palace Bowl. It's called America, and that's from his album Peace to the Neighbourhood. 12 minutes to 4, drive time after 4 o'clock this afternoon on Jazz FM. And recently I've been playing...
I lived in Hemel Hempstead, so the ad for Watford and St Albans was next door to where I lived. And so I thought I would like to apply for the licence. So somebody else and I just started to pull together an application. There was no way we were going to win it. But Paul Chandler rang me up and he said, listen, we're going for that licence, Chiltern is. Would you like to come and join us and work on it with us? I said, yeah, I will. I left Jazz and I went to work initially running Supergold, the AM service, and also working with them on the Watford and St Albans licence. I was there basically to be the station director, although I wasn't a director. It was. You know, I can't remember what I did, really. I didn't do very much at all. I think Chiltern had got wind of the fact that I was getting a licence together, and they just wanted to kill it off, you know. But they were always going to win it, you know. The station goes on the air before the studios are built, so temporary studios in a porter cabin. And it was a tiny porter cabin. I remember on a hot summer's day, there was no air conditioning in there, so we had to have the doors open of the porter cabin, you know. And so, you know, anybody could wander in, and they did. When I went to Chiltern, the first job I was given by Colin Mason was to fire somebody. You know, I thought he was completely wrong, and I told him so, but he didn't like the guy, and he wanted me to get rid of him. Which I did, and I found very, very difficult because the guy loved his job. Eventually, I got him back in to the station because I thought he was worth getting back. You know, and again, it's a good lesson to learn on how to do it. I found it really, really tough. But managing people is not easy, really, because you have to manage everybody to the way that they are because everybody is different. So it's, you know, it's not an easy task, really. I remember with Supergold, I think there were about 5,000 songs on the database that were in rotation. And when I got there, I thought, God, that's ridiculous. So I started chopping it down. You know, I got a lot of shit from certain people over this because, you know, there were songs on there I'd never heard of. I remember Colin Mason. One of his favourite songs was Spanking Our Gang. And I can't remember what it was called. I remember some. I took it off because it was an American hit and he came in because he used to do a Sunday show as Earl Vanderberg, I think he called himself. And so I'd taken this song off rotation and he said to me, I'm not happy, you know. And I said, what's the matter? And he said, you've taken that song off. And I said, well, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to put it back on? He says, so I said, all right, I'll put it back on. I didn't put it back on. I put it back on in his show every couple of weeks so he got to play it. Sunday will never be the same. Chiltern, they were a bit ahead of their time with their networking, but it was quite clunky how it happened, you know, with the splits, because it was before splits like today. I was only there for a short time, and then GWR did their takeover bid. I'd always been a bit anti-GWR. They, you know, were factory-produced radio. I remember going to a meeting when they bought Chiltern and all the GWR people were there, and I felt, oh, my God, I don't want to work for these. It's like, here we are, we're here to save you type of thing. Luckily, I was called up by Dave Lincoln, who said, we're looking for a deputy programme director at Key 103. And I thought, oh, I don't want to go and work up north again. But I thought, you know, I'll go and see him. And so I went up and met them. And I still remember when I got off the train, I'd never been to Manchester. I don't know what it was. I felt, I like this place. I really got a feel for it straight away. So I took the job and I've been in Manchester ever since for 25 years. Key 103. Because I was deputy PD of Key and of Piccadilly Gold. and you know, the gold guys have been there for years, and you know, the likes of Mike Sweeney, you know, I couldn't tell them what to do. They knew their job. They knew it. With the FM jocks, the key jocks, I remember one of the sayings I had was back in your box, because they had a tendency, some of them, to put a record on and come out into the office and have a bit of a chat. And I'd say, back in your box.
Morning, Key 103.
Good morning, Steve.
Yeah, good morning.
Listen, I'd really like to wish you all the best in London, mate.
That's very nice of you.
I've moved from London not long ago, and
we're going to have to move back then, aren't you?
Well, if you'll take
it. I was there for a couple of years, and it came at a time when the station was riding high when I first got there. Steve Penk was doing breakfast. He decided to leave and go to Capital, so the station had been built around Steve Penk on breakfast. And when he left, the figures started to go down, as they would, obviously. And also, it was hot AC. It wasn't very sort of, you know, up and Adam and modern with the music, apart from in the evenings. So the big sort of Manchester Britpop thing started happening. And so those kind of songs began getting played during the day. It was a bit of a shock for the station. It changed the sound of the radio station. So you lost the breakfast show. The music was beginning to change as well. It became a very difficult time for us, really. I think the station suffered. And anyway, I lost my job.
So for the last time, don't be shy. Wherever you are, finish it off for me right now. Here we go.
Well, when I left Key, I hadn't got a job, but I think the day after I left, I got a phone call from Jeff Graham. God love him. He said, yeah, I'm group program director for IRG, and we've got a station in Wigan coming on the air, and we're looking for a deputy program controller. So I was offered that job. The PD was Andy McPherson. Just before the station came on the air, Andy was offered a job at Galaxy, I think, and left to go there. So I was the launch PD of Wish FM.
And as we say around here, stand by, Skemsdale, we're ready for takeoff. Hi, this is Mark Keane in the morning, classic hits and today's best music, 102.4. Welcome to Wish FM in Wigan, St Helens.
Actually, for a small radio station, it was run very, very well. I mean, we had Rachel Steele used to do our Rage R debriefs, and, you know, we did it properly. In Wigan, Wish was hugely popular. Well, it was Wigan and St Helens, but it was massively popular. The studio was tiny, very tiny. You had to be careful of not hitting your head on the overhanging monitor speakers. At Wish, it was bought by Calvin McKenzie, and I didn't know what was going on, but I remember the managing director to see me, and he said, I can't believe I've just been made redundant. He said, I've been made redundant. I said, oh. So I went to see one of the owners of IRG. I said, what's going on? The MD's just been made redundant. What's happening? Is it going to happen to me? And he looked at me, he said, I'm really sorry, but yes. Well, I was out of work again and on the dole. I remembered thinking, what the hell am I going to do now? I wrote to John Bache, who was running Jazz FM in London and the Northwest. I said, I'm free if you've got anything going. And he rang me up and he said, look, it's a bit embarrassing, but I've got some tech op shifts coming up. He said, I'll pay your normal rate, but I just need somebody to do it. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. I don't mind. At the time, Mike Reed was doing the breakfast show, but he was doing it from his house in wherever he lives in Sussex. And so it was tech op from the studios in Manchester. And so I did that for a couple of weeks for him. And after that, they offered me drive time. Then they made me into station manager, which was a bulldog without teeth. There was no role. They needed somebody to call station manager, but I didn't have a particular managing role, really. But it was good fun. It was absolutely good fun. And then GMG bought Jazz FM. And, you know, I thought, oh, here we go again. Am I going to lose my job? But I obviously didn't, thankfully. And it was one of the most exciting times of my career, I think, because it was a hell of a ride. Because GMG, I remember John Myers saying, Jazz FM has got a history as a brand. So we're going to put some money into it to see if it works. And if it doesn't, we'll blow it up and do something else. And obviously, that's what happened.
102.2 FM, the hottest number in town. Yeah.
And then they decided that it wasn't working. So as a test, they would change the Northwest into something else. They didn't do London because that was too much of a risk because it got a reasonably big audience. They decided to launch Smooth. That was just unbelievable. Unbelievable. Because I'm just trying to think, what was I? Was I program controller then? I was offered program controllership, yeah. And I sorted the music out. And the format, even though it was going to be Smooth, was still jazz, soul and blues. And I think 20% of it had to be jazz, or what we perceived as jazz. And so we used the soul thing. And because Jazz FM had been sort of an over 50s male-dominated audience, we wanted to change it to female and, you know, 40 plus, really, or 45 plus. At the time, I thought, well, if you go back to the sort of mid-70s and all that disco soul era, kids growing up then are now our target demo. So we concentrated on the Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes type of songs, you know, and the OJs and all that. There was no other radio station at the time playing that kind of music, or just that kind of music. Obviously, we had to have jazz in there and blues, as in not really blues, but something with a bit of a guitar in it. And so it really took off very, very well. The first commercial I remember so well, it was a sophisticated lady getting into a Jaguar and turning on Smooth in her car. And it just sort of spoke about what the radio station was supposed to be. It was clear what the radio station was.
It's 8 a.m. on Tuesday, the 2nd of March, 2004, and a star is born.
It didn't take off straight away. We all know how well it's done. And there were many, many times when I used to go home worrying about pushing the boundaries a little bit with the music. We used to go fairly close to the to the edge, really, with what we used to play.
Love soft as an easy chair.
We were still committed to 20% jazz, and can't remember what the other percentages were, but they were laid down, and there was, I think there was also a speech requirement as well. And so we basically turned it into a pop format, but still keeping the elements that we were supposed to have in there. I mean, we had still had specialist jazz programs. Even when Smooth launched, they were retained. It was still specialist, but we would gradually, creep by creep, making it less specialist. And so that did concern me, and that if the radio authority came down on us, then it would be me that got the boot. But, you know, unless you take risks, you're never going to move forward. We did move the radio station forward for the right reasons. It struggled to get an audience as Jazz FM, especially in the Northwest. It was less than 200,000 listeners. And now, I don't know what Smooth has in the Northwest now, but it's got over, I think it's about a million, isn't it? So Smooth was revolutionary. People don't like change. And although it was a tiny audience, that audience liked what they heard. And so when Smooth came on, it was a completely different sound to what it had been. Eventually, it did become successful, and then they changed the London format from Jazz FM to Smooth, and it died. It absolutely died in London. Or maybe that's a bit unfair, but it didn't do very well. And then I remember sitting in a PD meeting, and so I just before GMG bought the Saga radio station, saying, you know, I'm really glad that I've been part of a small radio group, because we're all friends, we all get on, we know each other really well. But as we become larger, it's going to become more remote, which did happen. Although GMG were brilliant, absolutely brilliant, as John Simons and John Myers running the group were brilliant at it. So the Saga stations were bought, then they needed a group program director. John Simons was the group PD, and I was the brand PD. I think that's probably because, you know, I'd made a success of the Northwest. But that had its challenges as well, because program controllers have their ways of running things and they don't want this other person coming in. But, you know, you have to let them run their own ship. You know, they don't want this bloke from Manchester coming in telling them what to do, quite rightly. But I remember when, yeah, we did network. I remember when that all began to happen, when it was decided that we were going to, well, basically network. We still had a commitment to do some local, I can't remember what it was now, but I think it was drive time, but that was very difficult. I remember going to, I think I went on the day that everybody was told that there were going to be layoffs. I think I went to Nottingham. It was awful. It was like, I remember when I had mentioned I had to fire DJ from Chilton as my first job, how bad that was. Standing in front of staff, and although I didn't make the speech, then being told by HR that they were all going to be made redundant, it was bloody horrendous, and I felt so sorry for them. And you know, and I was okay, so they probably thought, oh, you're all right. So difficult. But that, I'm afraid that goes with being a manager, unfortunately. You know, if you have the responsibility and want pips on your shoulder, you've got to take the shit as well. It was very, very difficult. Then we launched as a kind of national radio station with a local drive time. That presented itself as a real challenge, because I would spend 2 or 3 days in London living in hotels, which was not great. And I think I was seen as this bloke from up north who's coming down here. It was challenging, to say the least. It was not what it was, obviously, but as five separate radio stations, it was great. When it became one, I found it harder. I found it much harder. And I don't know why. I think probably the presenters were, you know, they'd been around the block more, and so they were more of a challenge. And a lot of them were ex-BBC, and so weren't used to taking direction in the way that they had to. So that was pretty difficult, actually. It was great fun, but difficult. Then I remember reading in the paper, in fact I think Simon Bates sent me a link about these rumours that Global were buying GMG, and I thought, oh god, here we go again. You see, I knew nothing about this. I think initially we thought, oh, that's not true, but obviously it did turn out to be true. And I knew that my number would be up, because, you know, Global obviously run from London. So we went into hold separate for a couple of years. And that I found one of the most difficult times of my career, in that I knew that there was an end to it. I didn't know how long it was going on, and I hadn't got any control over me or the job I was doing. I still had day-to-day control. We knew that it was going to be another operation, and whatever I do now doesn't really matter. I had no influence in the end. I was just going through the motions of doing a job. And so, as much as I wanted to stay working for the company, I knew I couldn't. And so in the end, I just wanted to go, and did. For me, it was a sad way to go, really, but I'm really proud, really proud of what Smooth achieved in its time that I was there. Global have taken it to a new place, and it's now a major, major player. So, you know, I'm glad that I was in there at the beginning of it. Yeah, well, I'm of a retirement age now, so although I still record a daily breakfast show for 45 Radio, voice track it, which is good fun. It's on DAB in a few areas and also online. I still keep my hand in doing that. I run on the radio.co.uk for Roy Martin. It's his website, but I run it for him. Do some writing for Radio Today now and again. So, you know, I've still got my hand in and just enjoying life, really. How would I like to be remembered? Oh, God. I think somebody that cares, and I do care. I care about people. I care about radio. I think I'd be seen as somebody that has quite a strong opinion sometimes, but I would like to hope that my views are for the right reasons, and I do listen to what people say. I just like to be remembered as somebody that contributed to the wonderful world of radio in some small way, you know, not the biggest way, but in a small way. Thank you.
Steve Collins. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast. I'm David Lloyd. You can also get my book called Radio Moments, looking back from my very personal perspective on 50 years in British radio.